You're listening to Random Indies, candid conversations about geek culture. In this episode, I am joined by writer James Nis.
But that's just because I think a 3-inch figurine of me would be creepy.
I am with also founder and writer for Monkey Brain Inc., Chris Roberson.
I get drunk and talk about this stuff every now and then anyway, so it's just me creeping in front of the computer.
And good friend from Twitter, Bon, I'm hoping I'm saying this right, Ali Magna.
I don't think Marvel thinks that their head is up their ass.
I appreciate you guys coming out, or not really, just technically coming out. It's the internet, it's not as hard as it used to be, to talk with me, and we'll just dive right into our preset topics before hitting our main larger topic at the end. What I saw that really interested me this week is that there in Japan, there is a 3D printer out there now. I mean, 3D printing is something that people have now. I've gotten custom rings and little knickknacks and things made from 3D printers that are metal or plastics and stuff. But this 3D printer is like a photo booth, like you'd see at weddings or on the boardwalks at, you know, the beaches and whatnot. You'd sit there with your friends, take some goofy pictures for like 75 cents or a dollar or whatever. Well, what this machine actually does is give you a 3D plastic printout of you and your friends. And the prices start from $264 to $528 per printing. The sizes of these things are 10 centimeters, which to us Americans is about 3 inches to 20 centimeters, around like 7 inches. And it seems like a lot to me that's $264 for this thing, but it's your own private figurine. And the first thing I thought of right away was how awesome this would be at like a Comic-Con. All those people who cosplay in their little outfits, be able to get out there, get in that thing, and take a pic and have their own little figurine of them in their, you know, Darth Vader, Sailor Moon mashup costume. I don't know, would you guys think this would actually work in the just for Comic-Con?
Well, you know, I want to say that Gentle Giant or somebody did that at some point. Gentle Giant is the company that does some of the kind of higher-end action figure things that are based on 3D modeling, where they take 3D imaging of somebody and then reduce them down in scale. And I know that they have had booths and have exhibited like at San Diego. But I'm willing to bet money that at some point in the last 4 or 5 years, I walked by a Gentle Giant setup where they were at least talking about doing that. Oh. This is, of course, the difference here is that the thing that you see the link for has a mechanism that can actually do something with the imaging as opposed to just using it as a model and then go create something. I'd be really curious to see what happens if you jack with it. Like if you, because like a photo booth and you're standing there, the really interesting stuff would happen if you started moving while it was taking the imaging. Like, what is that model end up looking like? Things like that.
Oh, that would be kind of weird. It'd be kind of maybe matrixy, where you'd see like 3 or 4 arms out of the side of somebody. That alone could be pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. What do you think, James? Do you think people would be up for that? I mean, you're in San Diego all the time. You're around the cosplayers more than most people.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be down for it. I think the problem is going to be anybody having $500 to spend on a 10 centimeter figurine. If the price was down, sure. I don't know that it would be the first place I went. Mm. But that's just because I think a 3-inch figurine of me would be creepy. So I mean, I don't know. It the concept is cool. I think when it gets cheaper, maybe it'll be more popular.
Well, what is the price that you think is fair, that you think people would go for? You think around $100 for your own personal figurine? I mean, because people, I mean, if you go to Comic-Con right now, you see lightsabers and things being sold for $200 a piece, and people buy those every. I always see lines of those booths.
Sure.
People are willing to drop $200-$300 on a comic book from the 70s.
Right.
I think a cosplayer who's already chipped in, or it's already paid $1,500 to $2,000 for a costume, what's $300 more for a little figurine?
I mean, I guess. I think the problem is I don't cosplay, and I just don't. The idea of a little me on a shelf somewhere really kind of freaks me out. So I'm probably the wrong guy to criticize this, but I can see how people would get excited about it.
Sure. I don't know. I think that way you can get your own set of creator things. You get Mark Wade in there, Jim Lee, get your own little collection of them on your shelves. Who needs the Superman figure? Get the guy who draws Superman's action figure. That's what I'm talking about.
Of course, that's just begging for some crazy voodoo action, though.
Right.
Oh, then that's a whole nother market. Then think about that. You could sit there and be pissed off what Dan Slott's done in Spider-Man. You can get that figurine and smash it with a hammer or light it on fire and work out some of your aggression. That way, you don't have to yell at people on Twitter as much. It might be cathartic for people.
Instant Buddha dolls.
With this machine, could you do multiple people, or is it just one person at a time?
From what I've read, it seems like you could do multiple people. I mean, I don't know how big. I guess it depends on the scale of the booth. I mean, I'm like 6'5". I couldn't imagine three of me standing in a booth. So if the booth is large enough, I don't see, from what I've read and what I've looked up on it, it seems like it's completely possible. It's like anything. It just takes a little bit longer to print out and stuff.
So I'll say this. Back before I had joined Marvel several years ago, I ran Harris Comics, which published Vampirella. Mm-hmm. And our experiences at conventions were always interesting, especially when we had a live model hired. The fans loved to pose with the model, mm-hmm. And get anything signed by the model, not just comics, but, you know, clothing, their body parts, whatever.
Yeah.
If there isn't a publisher out there who isn't already thinking about this, they really ought to. And even if it's a price point of, I mean, 500 does sound a little high, but from collectibles that I'd sold back when I was at Harris, like I can see 250, 300 mm-hmm. for something that's relatively rare, something that's maybe like limited to 50, limited to 25. There's going to be a market for that, especially with something, you know, any property that has a long-standing fan base. There's gonna be at least 25 people out there who want to pay $250, $300 for something like this. And that might be all you need. And you'll walk away from a con with a fortune.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even think about that. Yeah, certain classic cosplay, especially like you get your Vampirellas, your Laura Crofts, things that, you know, guys are completely gaga over. And there are some great cosplayers out there. If you get one at your booth for that product, yeah, that's totally. I mean, I don't know how much it costs to set up the booth per se, but you said, yeah, $250 a pop. You get 20 to 30 people to do it. I'm sure that's got to at least cover your cost of setup alone.
Yeah, definitely.
There you go. See, that's the future, folks. 2020 San Diego Comic-Con. We're all going to be getting our own figurines made. It's going to be like the end thing. Next, what we have is what to me is just gives me a little giggle is that Neil deGrasse Tyson has claimed, but has pointed out a star in our solar system as where Krypton could have possibly been, a star that where it could have belonged to. And to me, mostly, I mean, it's cool that he's, I mean, it's Superman, it's not real, all this stuff. You can tell me that I'm a big that to me is seeing him in a comic book means that there is Neil Tyson in DC continuity now. And that to me has opened up tons of story possibilities with him. I want my Neil Tyson comic. He could be one of the 52. If Vibe can get a book, I think Neil Tyson can carry his own book.
Does that mean that Neil deGrasse Tyson no longer owns his likeness?
You know what? That's interesting.
I didn't check the indicia on that issue, but I'm not sure.
He's now property of WBAOL, and so I think it's cool when comics and just really almost anything like that can reach out and kind of play with the real world, saying, yeah, you know, we all know it's not real, but say if it was hypothetically. That's where it'd be. And to actually see Neil Tyson in the book, like James does. I went to San Diego this last year and I actually met Neil Tyson at the Hill. What bar were we at, James? Do you remember? I don't remember what bar we were at. But yeah, I met Neil Tyson, talked to him for a little bit. It was just cool to meet him. And now I was like, hey, I met someone who's in a comic book.
Have you seen that video of Tyson at the annual San Diego panel about spaceship design on Star Trek?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. He is one of my favorite just people out there. Just the way he so relates these complex subjects.
Oh, he was funny at the bar too, man.
Oh,
He was drinking quite a bit of port and he just started telling jokes. It was, I felt bad. I didn't know who he was. And I just thought it was a friend of a friend. And then we walked away and everyone started showing me his articles. I was like, oh, cool. Smartest guy on earth. And I was just sharing some beers with him. He was rad.
Yeah, he's just so personable. Like the one thing I always took from him is like, wow, he's almost as tall as I am. And I'm a big dude. I'm like, I did not realize. I mean, I see him on TV and all those things. I never realized how tall he is. Like, yeah, he's a pretty big guy. And he's just like James said, he's so personable. And it's just cool that someone like that shows. I mean, I don't know if he's a comic book fan or he's into Superman at all, but even just the thought that he might be into comic books, you know, warms my heart a little bit. That's all. I mean, why not?
I would be shocked to learn that Neil deGrasse Tyson had not read a comic or two in his lifetime. Just based on what little I, you know, what I, the interviews I've heard with him and the writings of his I've read, I think anybody that is that passionate about the design of the original NCC 1701 Constitution class Enterprise probably spent a little bit of time at comic shops.
Very true. Very true. So I say it was just cool. I say that he's in continuity. Just, you know, one of those cool things. Hopefully they come back to it later. And if Superman does have any more space problems or space questions, Neil Tyson can become a reoccurring character, supporting character of Superman. Why not?
I think it was on Chris Sprouse's blog. He was the one that drew it. That Tyson's one note was to shave a few pounds off him when they drew it. That was his only request to grant permission.
Well, I think that's everybody's thing. Whenever their likeness gets drawn in, you always want to drop 30 pounds and add 2 inches.
Yeah, that's going to be the most interesting thing about those statues, man. Everyone's going to see themselves.
Oh, yeah. See yourself in the glory.
Yeah, that's
yeah, destroy your self-image.
And then want a refund.
Yeah.
Hey, it's not our fault that you don't accept your own reality. You got to make sure that signs placed right there on the side of the thing. So, a big thing that we'll just talk about briefly is, as everyone knows by now, that Star Wars is coming back with a vengeance. And they've already got a writer attached to the movie, which is great. That means its progress is being made. But they still haven't nailed down a director. At least I haven't really read the news today. So they might have announced something today. I don't know. Is there anybody you think would be a good Star Wars director? Because they've had a bunch of people turn him down. Tarantino turned him down. I heard Brad Bird turned him down. Affleck said no. Spielberg said no. Is there anybody you guys think would be, or you would want to see in a dream situation, direct the next Star Wars movie?
Well, I feel like it has to be Joss Whedon. but I think because he's so tied up with Avengers, that's not on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they find someone else to replace him on Avengers, which I doubt is ever going to happen.
I don't think they'll do that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, I'd love to see J.J. Abrams do it, but, you know, I'm sure he's wrapped up with Star Trek and some other things.
Oh, that'd be, can you direct Star Trek and Star Wars? Wouldn't, like, the nerd universe kind of collapse upon itself if you were involved in both those movies at the same time? There's gotta be rules against that, right?
Yes.
What about Jon Favreau? He already turned it down, I heard.
Jon Favreau turned it down?
I could have sworn I remember
reading. I give up. I don't even want to see it anymore.
I don't. All these people, I guess to me, I see all these people saying no to it because no matter what you do, people are going to hate it. Because there's no way that you're going to be able to make a Star Wars movies that the hardcore Star Wars fan is going to like. Because it's never going to be as good as 4, 5, and 6 to them. No matter how you spin it, no matter, it's either going to have too much CGI or it's going to have too many special little Jar Jar type characters. They're never going to be happy. So maybe no one wants that grief.
Well, the problem now is the prequels were doomed, at least in the court of popular opinion, because you have generations of fans for whom that was their childhood. And then you're giving them this new thing. They can't possibly measure up to their memories of the thing they loved in childhood. But now we're a generation on from the prequels, that they're going to be people entering their adult life as audience members for whom their cherished childhood memories are the prequels. So, yeah, that's a tough road to hoe. Like, the only thing to do is to basically take those properties and make something new with it. Because if you try to please everybody in the audience, half of them are going to be mad it's not enough like the original films. The other half might be mad it's not enough like the prequels.
True. I mean, personally for me, I didn't have any trouble with the prequels because, I mean, I looked at them as they weren't made for me. Like, Star Wars, to me, is made for that 10 to 15-year-old kind of sci-fi fan who can, like, just stare with an open mouth at the screen and not dig too deep into why things are, want to know the physics behind something or the logic behind something. And, trying to watch those movies as being 30 years old when they came out, I just had to shut my brain off like it was a dumb movie, but take away all that, the cynicism I've gotten as I've gotten older, and just enjoy it for what it was, just a fun sci-fi romp. And I think if more people did that, they would have enjoyed those movies more. I mean, I knew they had flaws. I'm not saying they were great movies, but they were good.
You just have to embrace the fun of your viewpoint character being burned alive in lava.
It's all right. I mean, didn't that happen at the end of every great story, that you get your legs and arms cut off by your best friend and you burn in lava?
Sure, why not?
Is that the American dream? No? Just me? Okay.
was really funny, but I'll never forget this. I went to see episode 2 in IMAX. Mm-hmm. And this was after I'd seen it in regular theaters. And this is at a time when IMAX couldn't support a length of film that went beyond a certain point. So they actually had to go and delete 45, 50 minutes out of episode 2. And it was an amazing cut. It was literally, there's almost no Jar Jar in it. Almost every bad line was cut out of it, and it was actually a really decent movie at that point.
Wow, I wonder if that cut exists out there. Someone, you could actually grab an an original IMAX cut of that. That would be something I'd want to see.
Yeah, I thought they'd released that cut commercially, and then, you know, they haven't spoken of it since.
I mean, God, they've released every other version in Canada. They released a new version of Star Wars every, 3 years. You'd think by now they would have done the IMAX version. Huh, that's interesting. Well, we'll have to see. I mean, they're saying we got 2015 for 7, then every 2 years after that. Now, are they saying every 2 years in perpetuity? Like, we're going to get 2019, 2021, and we're just going to get, by the time I die, we're going to be at Star Wars 27?
I think they were saying that they were going to do another trilogy, because that's as much as George Lucas and his chairperson had scoped out in the treatment. But I would not be surprised if after... this trilogy is done, that they go ahead and actually try to reboot the whole thing. I would not be surprised at all. I think they're going to try to do what they can to keep this going in perpetuity somehow.
Yeah, I don't see Disney sitting on this the way Lucas did.
Well, no, I mean, I was just wondering, I know they're going to keep making these movies, but are they going to continue? They got the novels and the comics and everything that can continue the storylines. Are they going to keep doing that? Are we going to just keep moving down the timeline? Or like Bond suggests, you think they're going to reset? And start back at episode 1 again, or episode 4. I mean, the reset.
I hope not. I mean, I hope not. That'll just make it cheap after a while, man. I mean, after the next trilogy, if every 2 years we're getting a Star Wars movie, I'm just going to be over it.
If they did it in sets of 9, that means it would be every 20 years they'd be rebooting it. That's not completely terrible, is it?
Every 20 years, you know what? That's fine. I'll be dead after 2 So whatever, if that's what they want to do, go for it.
I mean, I would not be surprised if we see a brand new Batman trilogy even within the next 3 years. Like, I think it's gotten to the point that the Batman fan base is at this point almost expecting that every half generation there's going to be a new trilogy of Batman films. So that might be where Disney wants to get people with Star Trek, with Star Wars.
True. Now, do you guys think that the original cast, if they're moving forward, do you think the original cast should come back? Because, I mean, there have been talk of Harrison Ford and Mark Hamill and Carrie Fisher coming back. Do you think they should come back?
Yes.
Yes.
As long as there's no metal bikinis, yes.
Well, I think she has enough head start that she can get on at least into somewhat better shape. And who knows? Maybe Princess Leia let herself go. You know, she fought through the war. She relaxed, gave birth to a couple solo babies, and, you know, is just putting her.
Dwayne, you're a half the glass is half full kind of guy, aren't you?
I am optimistic, man. It's, life is dark in so many ways. I try to see the silver lining in everything.
Yeah, I'm down. I'm down for him to come back. I think it'd be fun if they were old, as long as they're not the main characters. Cool to see like a cameo or. You know, a little bit of screen time with each of them, kind of see where those characters are at. But I don't need another trilogy about them.
Oh, no. I mean, if the books are any course they might follow, there's tons of stories about Hans and Leia's kid. You got Luke training other Jedis where he could be like the Yoda or Obi-Wan figure. So there's a lot of ways. Yeah, I wouldn't want to see, you know, 90 to 200 minutes of them being old and trying to be
active. Star Wars Expendables.
Well, I mean, at a certain age, you can't be an action star anymore. There's a certain point when you reach, I don't know, around like, I don't say 50 or 60. It's not as believable when my grandfather is running around trying to kill people. It doesn't really sell me that much.
Wait, did you see the trailer for that new Schwarzenegger movie?
Yep. The Last Stand. I'm going to be there.
What now? Who? What?
Oh, it looks so bad. I can't wait.
The last I heard about Schwarzenegger is that he was going to be Conan again. What is he made? He made another movie?
Yep. Yeah, is it called The Last Stand? I don't even know what it's called.
I think so. It's the final stand or last. I don't know. All I know is there's mafia and they need a Schwarzenegger to stop them at the border. And he's the sheriff and he's going to lay down the law because that's what he does.
It's called, Last Stand. Good Lord, Schwarzenegger. He was our governor. James, how did we get him as governor of our state? How did we do that?
I don't know, man, but I'll take him back because he's Arnold fucking Schwarzenegger.
All right, moving on to the next.
Wait, before you go, 2015, you said Star Wars is coming out?
Yes.
That's the same year we get Justice League and Avengers 2.
Yes. Yeah. It's going to be a hell of a year.
Yeah, that'll be awesome.
I want them all to come out on the same weekend.
There'd be so many fights. No, man, that's a terrible idea.
Well, that's going to be the game of chicken of who gets released when, because
the DC and Marvel wars you would have at every single theater
Oh, come on.
No, that'd be
Do you imagine the local news of some guy in a Superman costume beating up some guy in a Thor costume because he took the last friggin' junior mint from the register? Come on. That'd be awesome.
So bad. So bad.
All right.
Because you're joking. I think it'll happen.
Oh, no, no. It will happen. I mean, come on. Oh, okay. People get into fights just alone in Avengers lines, let alone putting DC fans mixed with them, you know? So what we have next is a comic called Temple Run is in is one of the it's selling tens of thousands of copies. It's based off, I guess, an iPad game. I don't really have one of those devices. And to me, that boggles the mind that it sells. I've never heard of it, and it's selling tens of thousands of copies. And if you know, if you follow the market for the regular comic industry, tens of thousands of copies. I mean, saying if you double that, say if they're doing 30,000 copies, that's a pretty solid number. A lot of DC and Marvel books would be happy to be around 30,000 to 40,000 numbers. So this Temple Run thing, which I've never heard of, and I try to follow comic news in the industry as much as I can, it just surprised me that something I've never heard of could sell so many copies. It just shows to me that there are fans out there that the mainstream industry isn't hitting. I mean, if you look at Pocket God Comics, it sold millions of copies. And it says 19 issues. So, I mean, they're selling hundreds of thousands of copies of this book I've never heard of. I mean, how does that happen today that there's books that sell so much that could be completely off the mainstream? Is there really an audience that we're just not seeing?
Yes.
That's a short answer? All right. Good night.
Yes, everybody. The answer is yes. You know, I wasn't familiar with Temple Run. I heard about it from a friend of mine who's doing some work for the same company, Ape Entertainment.
Ape Entertainment.
Yeah. But the way that works is it's an in-app purchase in the game. So that's economies of scale. So these games that are available through iTunes on, you know, the iPhone or the iPad or whatever, one of the options in the game is to purchase the comic that ties into the game. And these games that sell millions of copies, if they're able to tap just a relatively small percentage of the people that are playing that thing on their device, it already is a much larger potential audience, that small percentage, than the entire direct comic market. Because the entire direct comic market is arguably somewhere between like 50 and 100,000 people all together. Mm-hmm. And the same thing happened when, I want to say it's the New York Times started doing their graphic novel list. And suddenly Diary of a Wimpy Kid was the best-selling comic in the country. Even mm-hmm. though it doesn't sell in comic book shops at all, it's a comic that lots and lots of people are reading outside of the comics market. We've gotten so insular over the course of the last 30, 35 years or so, defining comics as the things you buy at a comic shop, that there have been any number of successes outside of comics. And I did the same thing outside the direct market, that are clearly comics that sell really well. And we're not reaching them because we're just basically as an industry selling the same stories to each other that we already want. Mm-hmm.
So what can, I mean, you know, you guys are fairly intelligent, I assume. What do you think they can do? I mean, what is there something Marvel, DC, I mean, or Monkey Brain, is there anything you guys can do to try to reach these people? Do you have to develop a game for Edison Rex to maybe reach a different audience and then get them the back door into a comic?
Well, I don't think Marvel and DC, well, I certainly know Marvel. I don't think they need or even really want to reach out to a quote-unquote mainstream audience, because they basically have, between them and DC, they basically have a monopoly on the comic book shops. It's almost like a direct funnel of customers just for them. And in terms of the time and effort and money it would take to create something that would be more mainstream, to get someone who wouldn't normally walk into a comic shop to actually walk into a comic shop, they're, at this point at least, Marvel's not in a position to take, unfortunately, what they might think of as risk like that. Mm-hmm. It's totally, I mean, really the only, I think, you know, the only real growth path for the comics medium is through digital, honestly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's because there's nothing, there's very little filter between someone's iPad and someone's taste. Whereas opposed to the direct market, you've got Diamond, you've got the comic shop, you've got the need to drive or walk over to the comic shop, all these things standing in the way. And really it's the kind of thing where hopefully, as some of these newer publishers, you know, kind of follow what, say, like Monkey Brain is doing, and do, more 99-cent digital comics, that appeal to a wider variety of people, that's really the only way that you can expand the audience.
Well, yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying, that they don't need to reach for people to go to the comic book shops, but I know it's right now, it may not be the most popular opinion, but I mean, comic book shops, I mean, I think eventually aren't they going to go the way of the record store? I mean, I don't really see a Tower of Records around me anymore. I remember there used to be a couple down the street and they're closed up now, and I think they're GameStops or something. But aren't we going to reach a point, I mean, within not too long of a distance from now, that we're not going to really have other than but the small cluster of comic book shops? I mean, everything seems to be trending towards digital. So shouldn't we, as an industry, try to reach these Temple Run type fans and say, hey, you don't have to drive over to Gotham Comics on 3rd Street. You can just click right here for 99 cents. Boom, you got yourself a 16 or 20 page comic. I mean,
well, there's also the geographic limitations of, do you have a good comic shop where you live? Mm-hmm. And can you get to it? Is it a shop that stocks the kinds of things that you want? Because I think the lesson of things like Temple Run or Pocket God or Diary of a Wimpy Kid or Bone is that there's billions of people on the planet. And so the trick is doing a comic that's good, and then getting it in front of the kinds of people that would like it. I think the difficulty that the direct comic market has had is that the direct comic market, since the late 70s, early 80s, has been this kind of lifeboat of refugees from the collapse of the newsstand market in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, our lifeboat was populated by people that liked DC and Marvel superheroes in the late 70s, early 80s. And we've done a fairly good job over the course of 30 years of keeping those people entertained. The vast majority of people that are reading comics were either reading comics in the 80s when the direct market first started up, or came into comics with around the time of the Image boom in the 90s. And so, you know, there's kind of those tiers. There's not a lot of people younger than that. There's some, but there's just not a lot of, there's not a lot in a comic shop for those folks. I think that I've got like lots of long, screeds about this, but I've found something really fascinating in looking at, there's a website that shows the covers. Oh, this is too much of a digression. I'll do this some other time. The answer is yes.
What?
Okay. I apologize. I was about to launch into a big, like, 15-minute long thing. Can I try to summarize it really quick?
You go ahead, man. This is a free conversation. Go wherever.
Yeah, I'm curious. Go ahead.
There's a website, and I can send it to you, Dwayne, so you can put in the show notes or whatever. But it lists the month by month the covers of everything that was available on newsstands or comic shop stands for every month back to 1938. And so for one thing, it's a fascinating kind of like a time capsule to go back and look at what was on the stands when I was in middle school, what was on the stands when I first started going to comic shops. But then to also kind of look at the trends of what was happening on stands, what was available in comic form, whether it's magazines or trade paperbacks or whatever, every month for like the last 70, 80 years. And this really fascinating thing emerged where I was born in 1970. So I kind of like came of age in the last days of the newsstand. And Harvey Comics was ubiquitous up from the 50s, 60s, 70s. Richie Rich, Casper, I guess what? Dot was one. Anyway, those things, dozens and dozens of titles. There were something like, by the late 70s, 13 or 14 Richie Rich titles alone every month on the newsstands.
Wow.
And then one month in like 1981, they all vanished. Like one month, there's 14 Richie Rich titles on the newsstands. 2 months later, there's one. A month after that, there's zero. And they don't exist anymore. And it's because the people publishing those things were trying to milk all the blood they could out of the remaining stones that were in the newsstand market until it got to the point where it was no longer profitable to do. And they stopped. And I think what's been happening over the course of the last 30 years is our little lifeboat of people that left the newsstand and started going to the direct market to just buy the comics they wanted. And the comic retailers who bought them on a non-returnable basis from the publishers has been slowly winnowing. So the sales figures have been dropping steadily year over year with occasional bumps, basically forever. I mean, certainly since the 1950s, but definitely since the 1980s. And we've got to a point now where they're really at the break point, where when you have large publishers like DC and Marvel, that huge percentages of what they publish are not profitable. Mm. And only a small percentage of the books that they publish reach anything above something like 30,000 readers. You're really kind of teetering at the edge. And what I see happening in the direct market is, leaving aside content and appealing to markets and things like that, that just statistically, it looks like the newsstand did just before the newsstand basically closed up shop because it wasn't profitable. And in the same way, the direct market basically took the most vibrant parts of the newsstand and created a new economy out of them. I see that digital is a way out of where the direct market has been. And the best direct market stores will continue to exist. They'll continue to sell good books and, you know, action figures and statues or whatever. The crappy stores are going to go under, and lots of them. And it's going to happen pretty much all at once. In much the same way that after the speculator boom of the early 90s happened, something like half of the comic shops went out of business in one calendar year.
Yeah. So what you're saying about books being successful, is there a number that a Marvel or DC book has to hit to be successful? You said like 30,000 is a successful book?
Well, the threshold keeps dropping because in the 1970s, things like, you know, Iron Fist were canceled once they dropped below 150,000 copies. Now we've reached the point where the best-selling titles might crest 100,000 copies, and the majority of them sell below 30. Yeah. But if you look at the production cost of paying writer, artist, colorist, inker, letterer, editor, assistant editor, and then the entire back office staff of, you know, human resources and personnel and marketing, editorial, those things just don't generate enough income, no matter how many times they jack up the price on an individual issue. Once you dip below whatever that magic number is, 25, 20, 30, I just can't, it's not profitable. They're not making enough per issue to pay the people involved in making it.
I have the September sales numbers, and Marvel only had one book that went over 100,000. DC had two. And saying, if we're saying right now that 30,000 is the magic number to stay afloat, Marvel had 38 books under that number. And DC had 34 books that did not hit 30,000. We're saying is an arbitrary number right now.
Yeah.
That means that's about over half of their lines is not hitting the number to be profitable. That's kind of scary if you actually look at it. If half of what they're putting out is either barely breaking even or costing them money, I mean, you can't ride your whole boat on Avengers versus X-Men. I mean, that's kind of why we're stuck getting event after event, because they need something to sell 100,000 books. But that's got to eventually run dry. So how have they, I mean, it just seems like they're either blind to it or just refusing to see that what the path they're walking is one that's going to lead to failure eventually.
Well, no, it's because both of them are, both Marvel and DC are imprints of large corporate concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to continue to prove their worth to their corporate masters and hope that nobody really takes too close a look at the numbers. The other thing is, time was, ad revenue was a factor in a book's profitability. And so books would be filled with ads for movies and video games and cars and you name it.
Mm-hmm.
Take a look at any book published by DC or Marvel in the last 18 months or so. Every ad in it is a house ad for another product published by the same company, or an ad swap for ABC or somebody like that, that is also doing licenses based on properties owned by that company that has exchanged ad space with the company that they're already working with.
So they're just advertising to their base already.
I think they're moving money around from one department to another. Mm. I think that they're no longer above a threshold where advertising companies feel the need to spend any money on. And so they have to move money from one cost center to another. So they're essentially doing internal advertising and moving money from one cost center to another. But in a way that generates no revenue for the company. So if you're not looking at the larger picture, if you're just looking at what ad revenue did these titles generate, they can say, oh, this amount of money came in. But if you take one step back and see, oh, well, that was just paid by the marketing department, you know, of our same company, then there's no real net gain, and it's kind of pointless.
Okay. Wow. Just dropping knowledge there, Chris. Impressive, sir.
Sorry.
Well, along these lines is kind of the main topic of our conversation today is the changing formats of comics. like Chris said, comics have changed since. I mean, what just based on the numbers they used to sell, but also the way that they're presented. Comics used to be a larger size, more pages, and they've been getting smaller pages, more ads as we've gone on. But there's more than just what we have in American comics or floppies, with the dirty word people don't like using for. I don't know. What's the word you guys use for a monthly comic? Just a monthly comic?
Comic.
Is a comic a single issue, just a comic?
Comic.
Comic, okay. For a comic.
Yeah, it's a comic.
But there's also, like we know, a big thing for comics is trade paperbacks, is collections of stories. There's digital, what we have now. There's anthology style stories. There's manga that releases, you know, 800-900 page things every month or so. So there's a lot of different avenues that American comics can go from here. And what I'm just putting to you guys is, where do you guys see, like, what do you guys think the future of comics can be or should be in your guys' opinion?
Oof, that's a big question.
That is a big question. We tackle big questions here. Like, for example, like Eric Larson put, this was a couple years ago, and it came up again about how monthly comics are struggling in sales. And a suggestion he made that I really liked was a couple years ago, and he was on my show when we talked about it, was collecting the stories instead of putting out 12 Batman titles separately, releasing a Batman anthology book every month, where all the titles would be under one, would be under one 64, 90 page book or whatever for like $7-$8. You would get 10 comics all jammed into one thing. You would get your main Batman story, and then there'd be a you know, 16 page Nightwing, a 16 page Batgirl or whatever. And you'd have a Batman anthology, a Superman anthology, a Spider-Man anthology, where it'd all be in one thing. Is that something you guys would think could work?
I personally would think it would be cool. I don't think it would work. I as a reader would buy that and read it probably if I like things in it. But I think if you look at kind of other market segments, you know, books and magazines, things like that, that there's been serious moves away from anything like that format. People tend to like these days, smaller, cheaper doses of the thing they like, or a big concentrated dose of the thing they like. And they don't like the medium size, and they don't like having to pay for a bunch of thing if they're only going to really be into the small amount. I think personally, to answer your question, I think that a possible future for serialized comics is to go shorter, to go cheaper and exclusively digital, and then sell hard copy collections on a regular basis. So you would get like buy a chapter at 99 cents a piece, whether it's 8 or 10 or 12 pages. And then once you've got 100, 150 pages of that thing, you could then buy it for $19. So you could either consume it on a serialized basis in little bursts at a low price point, or wait until a book amount of material has come out and then pay a trade paperback cost for that.
Okay.
Yeah, I completely agree with that kind of model. That's back when I was running Harris, I actually thought of something like that, where I thought about either publishing a weekly digital comic, or actually just through Comixology or Iverse, or just publishing directly onto our website, which was vampirl.com at the time. And the thought I had was do these small, bite-sized weekly comics and then collect them together as comics, as floppies, essentially, and then collect those again as a hardcover. And even incentivize the hardcover by having one-of-a-kind special cover art commissioned just for that piece. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's one thing I learned from Harris, it's once you get a number of phone book size anthologies that you can just keep reprinting, you don't need that many. You just need a certain amount, and you could be set. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, I left Harris before it got to a point where we could publish two or three more, but the one that phone book size anthology that we reprinted, which had something I think close to 400 to 500 pages worth of black and white classic Vampirella comics, and that was just $20 for 500 pages.
Wow,
that was a perpetual seller. And we made so much money off that one book that if we had two or three more of those and just reprinted those every single year, we'd be set. We'd actually be set. And Marvel ought to be in a position to do something like that, but just because of certain people's attitudes at that company about stocking inventory and upfront costs, they'll never get around to it. But exactly what Chris said is the kind of model that I think will become very, very successful sooner than later. Chris, do you actually know if anyone Oh, I guess DC is sort of doing that now with their 99-cent weekly comics. That they're now, I see them accumulating them in comics, and I'm going to assume that they're going to reprint them also in trades and anthologies. But do you see anyone else doing anything like that? Like what you just?
Yeah, DC is kind of doing it because the stuff that they're serializing digital is their kind of half page model too. Because what they're doing in the comics, they're stacking to them. I mean, that's essentially what Monkey Brace is. We have deals in place to do trade collections of a number of our titles already. We're skipping the comic book, the floppy stage, because I think that there's too much overlap, at least from where I'm sitting, between the individual comic reader and the trade paperback people. So one would cannibalize the other. So, but you know, IDW is doing a bit of it. I know with their Transformers digital first comics, they've done that, and they're also doing it with Memorial, which is the creator of book I'm doing with them. Mm-hmm. My wife across the room is saying that she thinks Archaea is doing that, and that sounds right to me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think we're going to see more and more of that. And the reason is that so much of the potential profit of doing an individual comic, the saddle stitch stapled thing, is just chewed up in the production of doing it, printing it, sending it out to stores. If you do it digitally, you're just paying for the creative and editorial costs. And then you can do the hard copy collection, the trade, further down the line, and have already recouped some of the expense of creating the thing. And don't, you know, you get a bigger margin on a trade than you are an individual issue. It also has longer shelf life. It has an ISBN number, so it might be stocked at Barnes & Noble. It's easier for Amazon to ship it out. It moves from being the, I mean, comics that were always a ephemeral short-term product that we now have kind of fetishized as a collectible, but they're not designed to be really hardy and long-lasting, whereas anything with a spine, at least if it's printed correctly, would last longer. So mm-hmm. we're just skipping the middle step.
What is your take on would you rather publish a oversized premium hardcover before a trade paperback just to get the margins up further? Would you do both of those parallel? I'm just thinking in terms of what's an additional way to, especially for people who really enjoyed your work and want the best possible version of it to put on their shelf or you know, just put it up somewhere in their house. Do you think that's an option that everyone should take with every project?
Well, I think that the hardcover first versus trade paperback is really a question of what is your established audience already. If it's a huge name, historically the hardcovers used to come out first. You know, before everything was collected in trades, and it just became the thing that everyone was building towards automatically with every month of title. The collections were this kind of signature thing that only happened with books that people really wanted to have in this more kind of prestige format. So the hardcovers would come first. And that's the way it happens in the book world, in the prose world, so that you can get the hardcover of the new Stephen King before the paperback. And the way that is built is the people that really, really want it are willing to buy the higher price collection rather than waiting longer for the lower price. I think we've gotten things a little bit broken in the comics market by not understanding the use of the collection. But I think that if you're someone that's relatively not as well known, somebody like me that's just, you know, if you know my work, you like it, but most of the world doesn't know who you are, I think soft cover first and then trade later probably makes more sense because you want to build something where more people can buy in sooner. If you're a big, big name that already has an established fan base, hardcover first makes more sense because then you're going to maximize your margin and then do trade later for people that are willing to wait. But you know, for somebody like me, you know, as a creator, I'm not sure at this point the hardcover ever makes sense. I mean, I think that keeping the price point as low as possible for readers to buy in is the best way to go. Because you want to maximize the size of the audience, not the amount of money you can squeeze out of each individual audience member, if that makes sense.
So with digital, is there a sweet spot ratio to price to page? Because right now we still see with Marvel and DC that they're charging full price for their books, at least the month of. Month later, you get it for a dollar cheaper, but still, it's still $2.99 for a 20-page comic for digital file. It seems high. Is there, do you think, is I've always said 99 cents to me is the sweet spot for anything. I can go to the local 99 cent store and try to pick up two things and walk out with 37 things. And that's kind of what I think comics need to do. You hit that 99 cent spot, but how many pages should you be able to get for 99 cents? Are we saying 8, 16, 20?
In my personal experience, we're finding that anywhere between like 8 to 15 pages makes a pretty good ratio for a 99 cent book. That's a pretty good return on investment for the creators and the time they're putting in. And it feels like a significant enough chunk of story for the reader that they don't feel cheated. I think going too much lower than that, they would feel that they're paying too much for not enough. And going too much longer than that, it might not be worth the creator's time to do it. So I think right at, me personally, 10 to 12, 10 to 13 pages.
Okay. So, like, for me and for James, we're ourselves trying to get into the industry as writers and stuff. So we should be, as independently, if we're putting our own books out, you think as independently that if I was to do my own book, 99 cents, around like between 14 and 16 pages would be a fair price to put out for the book I'm trying to make.
As a reader, I would totally check out a book I've never heard of before for 99 cents. And if it was good and that length, I wouldn't feel cheated.
Now, does color or black and white make a difference for price for digital? I mean, it's just a digital file. I don't know if that changes your mind on anything.
That becomes an aesthetic choice at that point, because there are production costs. It's just the labor of doing it. So, yeah.
Now, do you think, I mean, like what you and Bob have been talking back and forth, I mean, to me, it makes a lot of sense. Do you think Marvel or DC would... Will it take something like a Monkey Brain or a Dark Horse or a smaller imprint to become successful doing it for them to get on board? Or do you think they'll ever, be crude to get their collective head out of their asses and get on board with what we think should work? I mean,
well, I think this is going to sound strange, but I don't think Marvel thinks that their head is up their ass. Or they right now they have a business model that works for them. And they don't want to do anything to change it. Because if they do, certain people are going to be very angry and probably let them go. Mm. So it's one of those things where I think they know that, of course, comics should be cheaper. Of course, you ought to get pages for more than $3.99. Of course you shouldn't try to, basically force a collector to buy, two issues of a comic series a month, but as long as there are people who are willing to spend $3.99 and buy 24 issues of Avengers a year and basically do all these other things, and there certainly are enough people who are doing it, they're going to keep doing it because it's just a business model that works. Yeah, for them, for their particular needs. I'm not saying that this is the way that everyone ought to do it.
From what we've seen with the Temple Run or whatever that thing was called, there seems to be a lot more fans outside of us, outside of the comic industry family, the 120,000 of us that there are. There seems to be a lot more of them than there are of us. I mean, logic would dictate you try to appeal to those outside of your circle.
Yeah, it would.
It would. Something I always try to go back to sometimes when I have discussions like this is someone told me once that Coca-Cola, they spend the vast majority of their advertising budget on Coke. And God knows that Coca-Cola has all these other drinks and beverages and products, but they still spend the vast majority of their advertising budget on this one thing that everyone's already familiar with. And the reasoning behind it is that your dollar spending on something that everyone is already familiar with goes a lot farther than trying to convince people who are suspicious or unfamiliar with the product to buy that product. And I think it's the same kind of principle with Marvel, where they know that their ad dollars or creative dollars just go longer spending it on Avengers than spending it on something brand new. Just the other week I was rereading, the cross-gen relaunches that they did. And I read Mystic, and Mystic is absolutely fantastic. And honestly should have been a blockbuster, and it wasn't. I mean, for all the, talk of what people want out of Marvel, they did really try. I was there in the meetings when they first started talking about the cross-gen. They wanted to take that opportunity to really break out of the superhero niche and try something new and different. And I think as the sales numbers start coming in, I think it became very clear that, there's a lot of people out there who want variety out of Marvel, but there's not enough of those to make a blockbuster. It's one of those things where I think the cross-gen experience certainly kind of reinforced in their minds that just the dollars go longer spending it on stuff that people already know.
I think Bond is exactly right. And I know anecdotally that many of the same things happen at DC. And I think that the problem is that virtually everybody running these companies now, and working at them for that matter, has come in into the environment that currently exists. So like I don't know that anybody at DC or Marvel was working at DC and Marvel before those companies derived most of their income from the direct market. It would have to be somebody that had been there since before the early 80s. I don't think that there's anybody still around. And I think in both companies, they do exactly that. They'll try something, and if it doesn't work, then they say, well, we tried that, it doesn't work. We're going to continue to do the thing that does work. But the problem is that because their test base is the people that already go on to comic shops, that all those experiments are doomed to failure. Because the people that we have that are still willing to show up every Wednesday to buy comics show up every Wednesday to buy comics like I do because we like superheroes. We like the kinds of stories that DC and Marvel have done for the last 30 years. And so if you try to sell us something that's different, it doesn't do as well. The problem is that, you know, you've got to do something different and then find some audience outside of the place where you sell your stuff. And that's a leap that they really can't make. Understandably, but you know, the fact that both of those companies control properties recognized around the world. I mean, Bon, you mentioned Coke. I mean, I guess you could find somewhere, perhaps in sub-Saharan Africa, where people don't recognize Superman, but you would have to look pretty hard. And yet DC cannot for the life of them figure out how to sell Superman in any media, to anybody. They just can't figure it out, where it should be a slam dunk.
Mm-hmm.
I think ultimately, when you were talking about kind of long term, what's going to happen, heads and asses and such. as I said, both of those are now imprints controlled by large, giant multinational entertainment conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
It is inevitable. I have placed a few bets on timelines, but it's inevitable that one of those two companies, a higher up above them in their corporate structure, is going to wonder what this line item in their budget is for comic publishing. And come in and ask them what they're doing, because they're not a profit center. They're right now ostensibly kind of geared up as intellectual property research and development. But all that they're generating in terms of profitable IP outside in movies and TVs and toys is stuff that's 30, 40, 50, 80 years old. One of those two operations is going to shut down, and it's going to happen pretty quick. Somebody higher up at Disney or at Time Warner will say, why are we spending this money?
Mm-hmm.
And they won't anymore. They'll license the things off. In much the same way that Disney has licensed out the Donald Duck characters since the 40s. And the entire landscape of the comics market will change basically with that one executive decision.
So,
and I'll put one more factoid that I didn't know until recently, which is that it has not been decided at Warner Entertainment who's going to be the head of Warner Entertainment after the end of next year. That this is, if you read the kind of like Hollywood Reporter Variety kind of stories, that there are three people that are possible successors of the current head of Warner, but that has not been decided internally which of the three will take over.
Okay.
And one of the three is the one that's the boss of the person that Diane Nelson, who runs DC Entertainment. But that the entire landscape inside Warner could change drastically in the next 13 months.
Really? So I follow along, is you're saying there's a possibility, remote or not, that at some point DC or Marvel would stop making comic books and would just be intellectual properties, as in they would continue to make Batman or Spider-Man movies and cartoons and toys, but we really wouldn't see monthly adventures anymore?
I don't think it's a possibility. I think it's an inevitability.
Really?
The question mark is, what's the timeline? How long do we take to get there? But when you're looking at an entire division of an entertainment company that is reaching an audience of 100,000 people, for companies of this size, that's not even worth taking time in a meeting to talk about. Mm-hmm. These are companies that generate, as the Avengers film. The Avenger film generates $1 billion of revenue. That's fantastic. You know, the comics cumulatively don't generate enough to even be anything but a box office flop. So it's not worth the company's time to continue to pursue. And I think that at the moment, people at both of those companies are working really hard, I think with the best of intentions, to do everything they can to appear profitable to the people that are above them and to appeal to the biggest audience that they can with, you know, their expectations. but that ultimately I can't see either of those companies continuing to spend money on something that nets them such a small return.
Yeah, I would unfortunately agree with that. I think with I know with Marvel, you know, it's not anything that they'll actively talk about, but I think it's in the back of everyone's mind. just the way that they count, you know, count income over there. I don't think it's a secret, but the comics division has to account for itself. None of the income generated by any other division at the rest of the company counts towards comics. So it's basically the comic publishing arm of Marvel Entertainment could be considered a profit margin drag. And it would be, you know, if somebody, for sake of argument, if a certain person who I think we all know woke up on the wrong side of the bed and looked at how much, you know, looked at where the profit was at Marvel, that person could very easily say, okay, let me just get rid of publishing, because that will then suddenly that'll stop dragging down the profit margin for all these other parts of the company. I want to hope that things change and turn around, but I think coming off of AVX, Marvel's doing okay, but who knows how long that's going to last. And if it goes back to where it was in 2010, we're probably talking about, I mean, if I was to throw a figure out there, I'd say 5 years.
To be fair, I usually say 5 years. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
There's a couple of bits, like interesting bits of trivia that I usually cite in these conversations, which I don't think are terribly widely known. The first is that in the mid-70s, the Salkind brothers wanted to make their Superman film at Warner. And an executive at Warner tasked one of their underlings to figure out who had the rights to Superman so they could license it. Mm-hmm. And it was only later in that week that they came back and they said, we already own that company. The DC was already owned by Warner, and they said, oh, great. And then they made the Superman film. Most people don't know that most of the books that made up, the initial Vertigo launch in the early 90s, 92, 93, Pete Milligan's, Enigma, Grant Morrison's Sebastiano, things like that. Those books were all developed by Disney for an adult, mature readers comic line called Touchmark. That was going to launch under the editorship of, I think, Art Young. And Disney looked at it finally in the last moments after everything was ready to go and said, this isn't worth doing, and stopped doing it, basically shuttered the line. So Art Young and those titles ended up going over to DC under Karen Berger, where they became the foundation of the Vertigo line. But Marvel has never, in its 80-year history, had a long-term publishing... Disney has never had a long-term... publishing plan. Mm-hmm. And if I just said Marvel about Touchmark a minute ago, I'm in Disney. I've gotten to the point now where I can flake them in my head, and I apologize.
Okay. Wow. Sorry. I'm going to try to absorb all this information you're throwing at me right now. I'm scared for the industry that if the two biggest publishers are not making books in 5 years, where does that leave comics? I mean, does that mean the industry itself?
I think that creatively, comics have never been healthy. I think that the overall level of quality, including work for hire stuff coming out from DC and Marvel, by and large is higher than it's ever been. And there's certainly a richer wealth of material now than we've had at any point since the creation of direct market. And I think that comics will survive fine. I think that bad comic shops will go out of business pretty quick. Mm-hmm. But comics will be fine. I think readers, it'll be different, but it won't be catastrophic.
Okay. I think when I say 5 years, I mean that I think print comics or the direct market as we know it is not going to be around in 5 years. But I think what's going to happen is just everything we've been talking about. So much of the readership is just going to go digital, that as iPads and iPad minis and Kindles and Nooks get cheaper and cheaper, it's just going to get to a point that people are going to, you know, especially kids growing up nowadays who are going to grow up with an iPad mini in their cribs. They're gonna think it's not unusual at all to buy a comic just by tapping a couple buttons. And so I do foresee a world where, you know, pretty much everything being published now just ends up moving over to digital.
Well, that's what I mean. I've kind of feel too, and you see how well received just a lot of the smaller imprints. I mean, just Chris here, we can talk about the Monkey Brain books. I mean, I've heard nothing but great things about
all the books on the line, and some of them, just looking at them initially, are not necessarily my, you know, my cup of tea or my bag usually for comic books. But like we've been saying, that 99-cent price point, I'll go click out and check out a Bandette that I probably wouldn't have read before. But 99 cents, you know, I lose that on my couch every day. Why not get a, you know, something that'll entertain me for a little bit? And then I find myself hooked on this book that I may not have tried, but it's just hitting that sweet spot in the price. And I think that's where we need to, hopefully, as the industry moves towards that, is trying to appeal to more of a mass audience.
Totally. You know, like, it's almost one of my rules of thumb. When anybody tells me that everything published by Monkey Brain is in their wheelhouse and appeals to them, I worry that I'm doing something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because it shouldn't. You know, I want to publish one of everything, 10 of everything, like something for every possible reader. And, you know, most readers are not going to like everything. You know, they'll look at a lineup of stuff and say, you know, these few really appeal to me. I might try some of the others because they're cheap, but ultimately they're not going to be in my bag. And that's fine, because I think that where we have failed as an industry creatively is that we have done a really good job of evolving into a machine that publishes lots and lots and lots of things for the people that like the kinds of things that we publish. That if you like the stuff being published by DC and Marvel, or, you know, whomever, there's more of it out every month than you could possibly keep up.
Yeah.
But that if that stuff doesn't appeal to you, there's virtually nothing that you can, I mean, or there's a very, very small amount of stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think that we'd be better off somewhere closer to the middle, where as a reader, if I look through a catalog, maybe 25% of it appeals to me. That would be great, as opposed to reading a catalog that appeals 100% to me, and I know for a fact that the majority of people walking down the street couldn't give a rat's ass about most of it. I'd much rather have something for them and something for me, and I think we'd all be healthier.
Mm, true, true. I guess, I mean, that's a lot of what we were talking about mostly, is that how we're so set on trying to appeal to that same 120, that it's okay to have that 120, but not to forget about the 230 other million people who live in this country and the 6 billion people else on the planet. So, I don't know. Oh, that is a lot of knowledge and information shared today by you guys. I'm impressed. I'm going to re-listen to this and take copious notes. Well, is that I have really, I mean, I think this is a lot we've talked about, a lot for people who've been listening to take all in. So I want to just cut right here. I would love to have you guys back on, continue this conversation, or just on another topic, because you guys are a wealth of comic knowledge. I really appreciate you guys coming out tonight.
Sure. Anytime. So, I get drunk and talk about this stuff every night anyway. So it's just me doing it in front of the computer.
Well, then, okay. I'll have to bother you every month then, sir.
Yeah, anytime. Anytime.
All right. Before I let you guys go, I know, Chris, if you want to plug Monkey Brain so people can, I'll put it in the show notes, but if you want to let people know what Monkey Brain is, just in case they haven't been following along or know what it is, what we've been talking about.
I'll just say monkeybraincomics.com. Go check it out. It's a bunch of comics that we have made available for sale. I will point out that depending on when this goes up, will this go up in the month of November?
Yes, it'll go up by the end of the week.
Okay, great. For the month of November, Monkey Brain is donating all of its proceeds as a publisher. The creators still get their cut, but our profits as publisher all go to the Hero Initiative,
mm-hmm.
Which is a charity that's designed to provide financial and medical and whatever support for veteran comics creators who have fallen on hard times, because the majority of them have worked for page rates. And once they're no longer the flavor of the month, they no longer make an income. And many of them have created characters that have gone on to be on the silver screen or in toy aisles, mm-hmm. or continue to appear in comic shelves month after month while they live in assisted living diminished circumstances because they don't have any money. So donate to the Hero Initiative, or if you like, you can buy Monkey Brain titles in the month of November, and some money will go to the Hero Initiative. And that's all.
Yeah, well, yeah, we let on the show, we talked about your charity drive at the beginning of my show earlier in this month. So hopefully the fans have been buying, even if you're not interested so much in Brain before, this is a good, just to help the initiative out and get some pretty cool books as you're doing it.
Yep, or they could always just donate directly to the Hero Initiative. That's great.
Exactly. So, all right, guys, thank you for being on, and I'll talk to you guys again real soon.
Yeah, thank you.